I'm Joseph.
And I'm Nick.
And this is Fish Jelly. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. So we have to talk about RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars 9.
Oh, we do? Okay. Let's do it. More Drag Race.
Well, there's a new season of All-Stars that will air in May.
I rue the day. I miss the days where there would be notable breaks between seasons of these things.
Well, let me get your so this season is going to be different because there are eight queens, and the eight queens are playing to win, but the cash prize will go to the winner's charity of choice. So this will be a charitable function.
Okay.
So I'm going to name them and then you can say what you think. So we have from season 14, Angeria Paris Van Michaels, who will be playing for the National Black Justice Collective, which helps empower queer people of color.
That's great. Yeah, like her, that ugly bitch. Yeah,
ugly bitch.
I remember finding her very entertaining and sweet.
Yeah, she's real country, which I liked. Next from season 13 is Got Mick, who is playing for Trans Lifeline. Got Mick was the first openly trans man on the show.
I find Got Mick a bit dull, but and the wasn't quite able to articulate certain issues about her privilege, but or their privilege. But I see Got Mick all the time out in L.A. Yeah.
Got Mick did for Snatch Game Paris Hilton, which was really good.
The Paris Hilton bit was good. Again,
and Got Mick's fashions were really great.
Again, they're very talented. I just was a little bored. I don't know.
From season 14, Georges, they're playing for the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Georges is seems very sweet, and I think everybody likes watching Georges dance. And I hope that he's come out of his shell a little bit.
Yeah, Georges was very limited, like couldn't speak. Well, like literally said, like they had a hard time, like public speaking and comedy and acting, and they were in the bottom every time they had to do any of those things.
Yeah, well, he's young, you know.
From season 11, Nina West, who's playing for the Trevor Project.
Yeah, Nina's okay.
I thought Nina was like a good actor and was funny, but their fashions were like atrocious. Because I recall like Michelle Visage making fun of Nina West's silhouette because like he's built like a linebacker. Mm-hmm. And
well, Nina feels like one of those old school Midwest drag queens that I would see that you'd see everywhere growing up. Because I believe she's a Minnesota gal, right?
I think Ohio.
Or Ohio.
But Midwest.
Midwest. I mean, that tracks. I don't know. And, you know, that's something that needs to be in existence. She doesn't excite me. I don't know.
Then we have from season 11, Plastique Tierra, who is the most popular RuPaul's Drag Race queen on social media. Like, she has, like, damn near 12 million followers on TikTok and... So she's known for looks. She can also dance. She's also, I think, if not the longest running, one of the longest running performers on RuPaul's Drag Race Live in Vegas. So we know she's polished. She's playing for the Asian American Foundation. I thought she was boring.
She was boring on her season, but seeing what she's done since then, I'm curious to see also, like Georges, have you become a little more comfortable in your skin? Because clearly the drag is fantastic.
Well, she seemed fake on her season. Like she can remember that she's known for RuPaul giving her the hug because she was crying about not being accepted. And
yeah.
I don't know. She seems kind of fake to me. I mean, hence her name. But
well, we're all, as Amanda Seales has confirmed for us, we are in a society that wants performance.
From season 5 and All-Star season 2, there's Roxy Andrews. She's playing for the Miracle of Love, which is like a foundation that supports people with HIV and AIDS. The thing I remember about her is her lip sync of Whip My Hair, where she did the She was the first queen to do a wig reveal under another wig.
Yep.
And then she had the story of how her mom left her and her siblings at the bus stop.
Yep.
And then I always think about Katya making the joke about the bus stop. Mm-hmm. I didn't like Roxy on season 5. She was a mean girl.
She was a stupid girl too. If you're going to be mean, be smart. You can't be fucking stupid.
And then every like clip I see of her online is always like, it's always her being like mean and like clapping back at someone's comments. And so I don't know. She's not my favorite at all.
I mean, again, I think some of her drag is impressive. To watching her perform can be impressive. I don't like her.
From season 1 and All-Star season 1, the very first queen to ever step foot inside of the workroom, it's Chanel. Chanel's playing for the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. And I always have to say, Chanel was the first drag queen I used to see perform in college in Vegas at the gay bar Gypsy, which mm-hmm. no longer exists. And I always really liked her. Of course, season 1, she came across a little arrogant.
Abrasive, yeah.
And ended up kind of like deciding she was going to leave. Mm-hmm. And then for All-Stars 1, she did perform well, because that first season of All-Stars, they had to perform as pairs, mm-hmm. which is how... oh God, what's her name?
Pandora.
That's how Pandora got messed up. Mm-hmm. But Chanel went far because she was paired with Chad Michaels, who ended up winning All-Stars 1.
Yes.
You know, she's older. I think she's like my age. And
don't bring your purse to her show.
She looks, and yeah, she got in trouble for stealing. but you know, who hasn't? And
true.
She,
yeah, I can't speak.
Yeah. And she looks like she's been touched, you know, filled and plumped. And I guess I have a fondness towards her. So I'm looking forward to seeing what she can do all these years later.
Sure. I wonder if there's a limited number of queens because they're not actually getting money.
Well, I'm sure they're getting paid.
Well, not $200,000 if they win, though.
No, but there has to be some incentive. Like they're receiving a stipend, like for costumes and a fee for the appearance. And I can't imagine that they're not going to be big cash prizes for every episode. But since there are only 8 queens, this would be a shorter season. I wonder if this is just like a special that Paramount, not unlike that holiday special, maybe. I don't know. But rounding out this pack of wolves is from season 10 and season 11, Vanessa Vanjie.
Oh yeah, Mateo, lest we forget.
Who we all remember from her first season being eliminated first and then leaving the runway saying, Miss Vanjie.
Yep, and now we've all been treated to her selection process to find a mate in Hollywood.
Yeah, she had a show on WOW Presents Plus called 24 Hours of Love. She's playing for the ASPCA. I'm only laughing at these because I feel like the organizations they chose say a lot about them, perhaps.
Yeah, sure.
Vanjie's loud and obnoxious and grating, but in a way that isn't like I don't despise her.
She can be endearing.
She's just a bit much. Like yes. There's never a turn down button. So after a few, you know, after 30 seconds, it's like, okay, enough of Vanjie. Mm-hmm. But if people haven't seen that 24 Hours of Love or whatever it was called, well, would I recommend it?
I mean, I think it's a waste of your time, but it will. The tool that it gives you if you live in LA is you can see these fools at bars all over here, and then you can know that says a lot about them having appeared on that show.
Yeah, but anyway, of these, who do you think would go home first?
We kind of talked about this, probably. I don't want Georges to go home first, but maybe.
I think Georges. And then who could you see being in the top?
Angeria. Who do I want to see in the top? I don't know. If Roxy knows how to play the game better, maybe her.
I could see Angeria, Roxy, Nina.
I think Chanel will get caught up on her own. She'll be her own fall, probably.
Yeah. But I mean, whatever. We might. I don't know that I would want to talk about this on Patreon, but we already did a season.
You already know there's going to be a couple episodes where no one's going home.
Well, I'm also wondering if anyone's going to go home. Like, if they're all playing for charity, wouldn't it seem like they all need a fair shot at winning? So maybe they're going to do like an all-winter season where no one goes home, and then they just, because there are only eight of them.
Yeah.
But moving on, since you brought her up already, but I feel like we have to talk about Amanda Seales on Club Shay Shay.
And I've only watched a third, listened to a third of it, because it's damn near 3 hours.
It's over 3 hours
long. And I have a lot of shit to do, so.
I have listened to it. And there's a lot to process. And of course,
there's a lot to process. We've already had a very, I don't want to say heated discussion, but.
Well, that's every day about anything. But yeah, there's a lot that could be talked about. And then, you know, depending on your algorithm, you probably see a lot of posts about her.
Mm-hmm.
But what did we learn? So for people who don't know, Amanda Seales is probably most known for being on the HBO show Insecure, the Issa Rae show.
Mm-hmm.
But she worked before then. She was actually a child actor who did a show on Nickelodeon. There was a group called She Can Sing, and there was a popular, like, back when, like, that neo soul, like Erykah Badu, like, there was a group called Flowetry. And one of them, it was a duo, two ladies, two British ladies. And one of them left the group. And so Amanda Seales got brought on to like do like a tour to replace the lady, which was contentious because the fans didn't know. Like, imagine buying tickets to go see. I can't think of a duo, like a musical duo right now. But who's that group, that Canadian group that sings the song, I Feel It In My Bones? I'm looking out my window. They were on Canada's Drag Race. They look like sisters, maybe.
Oh, yes.
Or they're lesbians.
Tegan and Sarah?
Tegan and Sarah. Imagine mm-hmm. if you go to see Tegan and Sarah, and instead of Tegan and Sarah, it's Tegan and Jenna Bush or something.
Ooh, I don't know. Not anyway, a Bush girl.
I don't know. I'm struggling here. But anyway, Amanda Seales has done quite a bit, and then she also hosted The Real, that talk show, that daytime talk show with...
Oh yeah, Lonnie, I forgot Love about that. Yeah,
Tamara Mowry and dot dot dot.
Is that show still on?
I don't even know. But so she's done quite a bit, but she's known in the industry as being difficult. Like, people don't want to fuck with her, and so here she is on Shannon Sharpe's show. And the one thing I know for sure is when you let people talk for too long, they're just gonna say some shit they don't need to say.
Yeah,
which is why I like to be quiet sometimes, because I know we're gonna get into an argument, and I'm gonna say things that I don't really want to say. But I feel like I have to say something. Uh-huh. So that's my first issue with these interviews. Like, I really like Club Shay Shay. I think Shannon Sharpe seems like a sweet guy. And if he were my uncle, I would just love, like, Uncle Shannon.
He's sweet, but there are things that he does not need to weigh in on or speak to.
Well, he's so limited. I'm not going to say he's not smart, because he's very successful, right? He's succeeded in professional sports. He succeeded as a broadcaster. He succeeded as an entrepreneur. He has his successful line of alcohol. And then he has this uber popular YouTube channel.
Uh-huh.
So he's not a dummy, but I think he's limited. And it's very obvious when he's speaking to people like an Amanda Seales, who has a master's degree in race studies. She's a scholar of race. She's mm-hmm. also a Black woman. So she has a lot to say and a lot to support how she feels about she knows to be true.
I mean, and I've already known this about her. I mean, she's incredibly articulate.
So I think Shannon Sharpe, someone should have prepped him to not challenge her. And if this is what they want to do, then they're essentially just giving her a platform to talk.
Because, he says at one point, like, this is your interview. Yeah. So,
after she chewed him out a little bit.
Yeah.
She reminded me of you in a way, like, smart and articulate and just combative. Like, you're not, like, you can't say anything to people like that. Even if it's true, you're going to argue. If I said, Nick, the first thing he did this morning is get up and get coffee. No. That's not what I did.
Well, it's not about arguing. It's about clarifying sometimes.
But you still interrupted me, because that's what you do. Like, you cannot let anyone speak for you even when it's true, because you'll immediately say, no, I didn't get coffee. And then it's like, yeah, you did. You got up and you went downstairs. Well, I put on my robe first, and like, you're not going to cast aspersions on me. Like, it's just like, you think everything's an attack. So I feel like the overall energy I got from Amanda Seales, from watching her on The Real and she has a stand-up special that's really funny. Mm-hmm. Should we explain the moment in her special that we always quote?
Yeah.
She's talking about how men are like, it's so hard to date men because they're so damn stupid and say things like men will say things to you that immediately turn you off. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, I was on a date with some guy and he just said, like, I don't fuck with Stevie Wonder. And it's like, what?
She's like, why would you say that now? Stevie Wonder, now I can't fuck with you.
But the one that we always talk about is... She said she went on a date with a guy and he said, I don't fuck with birds.
She's like, oh, like birds, like loose like, women.
Like
okay.
Loose women, like chicken heads. And he's like, no, like birds with wings.
She's like, she goes, this is what we say all the time. Like, what are we talking about now?
And then she goes, what are we talking about now? So we say that a lot, or we say, I don't fuck with birds a lot. So I definitely appreciate Amanda Seales. And I just wanted to touch on a few things that, I noticed people were talking about online. So first of all, Amanda Seales revealed in the interview that she was very recently, like this year, diagnosed with autism. Mm-hmm. And she explains, like Shannon's asking her, so the thing that was making headlines is that Shannon kind of questioned her about her autism, like basically saying like all these things that you're saying are symptoms of autism, like her being very detail oriented and distracted about certain things. And she called them like sensory type things that she feels she has to do, which I guess have like a cute little colloquial name.
Stimming.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's the word I was looking for. She was sort of saying all the things she does that exemplify stimming. And then Shannon Sharp was kind of questioning her like, well, couldn't that just be this and that? So at first people were like, cancel Shannon because he's questioning her autism diagnosis. But then here's where things get kind of crazy, because then Amanda revealed in a live after the interview aired that her autism was not diagnosed by a clinician.
I didn't know that. Okay.
So did this bitch just read like what are the symptoms of autism and decide that she's autistic? So that's getting a lot of whatever.
Wait,
But then after she said that, and then that kind of blew up in the little world of people who are interested in whatever the fuck she has to say, after that blew up, then she clapped back and said, oh, my autism diagnosis is not anyone's business, which I kind of have feelings about, because if you want something from me based on your disability, then I think I have a right to ask you to prove that disability. Like, I know part of the ADA says that if someone has a handicap placard, you're not allowed to ask them what their disability is. But that's separate. I'm talking about, like, you want me to do something for you or feel a certain way about you because you claim that you have a disability. I think I should be allowed to ask, like, where's the paperwork, bitch? Where's the who, what doctor, what therapist diagnosed you with this?
Oh, you know what this sounds like? It's blowing up to be like what's her name? The lady that wanted to be black so bad.
Rachel Dolezal.
Rachel Dolezal.
Who has an OnlyFans where she sells pictures of her feet. She's also a painter.
I know. I feel bad about Rachel.
I feel bad for Rachel, but she's, Anyway. So I don't know. I do have strong feelings about people self-diagnosing and then making it their narrative that, like, I suffer from OCD, ADHD, anxiety, depression. It's like, according to whom? Because you listened to a podcast where they talked about it and you think that fits you? And
okay, I do find that to be kind of, that definitely is a problem. But the way she's selling it to Shannon Sharp is that she just learned, as in was diagnosed, is what that conversation sounds like right to me.
So now it's a little murky.
It's a little murky, especially from somebody so detail-oriented.
Moving on to, of course, her relationship with Issa Rae has, you know, people have said like, oh, they had a falling out. And so she kind of explained what that was. And she starts off by saying Issa Rae's publicist, you didn't hear this part, but she tells like this, it's a 3+ hour interview. And she takes 30 minutes of that to detail like how she has felt like for all this time she needed to protect Issa Rae. So she never spoke ill about her, but now she feels like she no longer needs to do that because Issa Rae is not protecting her. Well, and of course Shannon's like, well, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, give an example. So she tells this 30-minute long story about how there was a Black Emmys party that she's saying that Issa Rae's publicist, this lady who's like a white presenting Latina woman, always had like an attitude towards her. And that this woman was organized. So this like white presenting Latina woman organized a Black Emmys party. So there's this Black Emmys party, and Issa Rae was invited by Jesse Williams. Mm-hmm. She said, oh, my friend Jesse Williams texted me and said, come with me to this Black Emmys party. And she's like, yeah, of course, I want to go. So she goes, and when she gets to the door person says, oh, you're not invited. Like, your name is on the list to not come in. Uh-huh. So she's like, okay, so she leaves. But then as the way she tells the story to me is so unbelievable, because she says she was like, well, I'm not. So then the person she went with, because it wasn't Jesse Williams who went with her, he just told her to come. So the guy she went with, or the lady, someone got in. Uh-huh. So then she's like, well, I'm not just going to stand there and wait. So I left. And as I was walking away, another Black actor saw me and said, where are you going? Oh, I wasn't allowed in the party. No way. You come with me. You can come with me. So she goes back a second time. Ooh. They don't let her in. So she says, I'm not going to wait. So she leaves. And as she's walking away from the party, another Black actor or someone sees her and says, where are you going? Oh, I got kicked out of the party. Oh, no. Well, I'm one of the organizers, so you can definitely come in with me. So she goes back a third time. They let her in. And then while she's standing at the bar getting a drink, she claims that a security guard walked up to her and said, I'm sorry, but I have to ask you to leave. And then she became argumentative. Her own words, like, she wouldn't. This is the other thing. If you're at a private function and someone tells you to leave, then you get up and leave. Like, who are you to argue? That'd be like someone comes into my house and I say, please leave. And you want me to explain why?
But it's not somebody's house. It's
a private function.
It's a private function. But what the way that they... According her, from her perspective, I can understand being upset. And it was what this person did was going on.
Well, let me continue. Okay. So then she won't leave. So other security guards come. And then she claims one of them said, you need to get the fuck out of here. Like, she makes it seem like they were like really aggressive with her and she wouldn't leave. And so someone pushed her, or like the security guard grabbed her, or like she, and they end up pushing her. So now she's like, I was assaulted. And then they told her, she said, I'm not leaving till the person who told me to leave explains to me why. And they said, no. And then she just ends up leaving. But then she confronts Issa Rae about it. And then Issa Rae finally, after like 3 weeks, says, fine, I think she mediates a meeting between her publicist and Issa Rae. And do you know what the publicist tells Amanda Seales? You weren't invited because I don't like you. And this is where I just think that this someone like Amanda Seales is always going to paint a negative. She's always going to end up painting a negative picture of herself, because it's like, just like the Monique interview where you listened to almost an hour of it and you heard her say in the hour.
I think I listened to all of the Monique eventually.
No, you did listen to Monique. I'm saying for Amanda Seales. Okay, you listened to Amanda Seales for an hour. And how many times did you hear her say, people think I'm difficult, people don't like me, people say I'm... She said that so many times in the 3-hour interview. And all she demonstrated in the 3-hour interview is like, girl, you do seem difficult. You do seem like no one can tell you shit, that you're gonna... She even says part of her autism is that she has to correct everything. Uh-huh. And I don't know. I just feel like you're making all... Because at one point, Shannon asks her, what don't people like about you? Mm-hmm. And she goes, well, I thought about this and I had to explain this before, so I have a list. And she runs down the list of all the reasons why people don't like her. And everything she said are reasons why most of us don't like people. Like, know-it-all, like, too detail-oriented, easily distracted, like, we can't get through shit because you were like... She thinks that she... Because she keeps saying, like, all I need is information. Okay, if I'm a director or producer... Am I going to hire someone who is just like Monique? It's like, I wouldn't hire Monique for anything, because you're telling the world that if I hire, just like how Lucas Haas says, when you hire Lucas Haas, mm-hmm. and we talked about it in the review for Cash Out, but I think Lucas Haas is probably a really nice person to work with. Like, that's his vibe.
Well, because he's thankful and easy to be there.
Yes. Well, Amanda Seales' vibe and Monique's vibe tells me that if I hire this bitch, like, I'm going to have to accommodate her in so many ways. Amanda Seales is saying, I need information. I need people to do what they say they're going to do.
But
you're more hassle than you're worth. You're not wrong. But
she's
it's like,
not wrong. Yeah.
You're not wrong. But the thing that I want to impress upon people is like, no one has to like you. People think that like you can be a dick and an asshole and that somehow people still have to fuck with you. No, they don't. I don't have to fuck with you. I don't have to invite you anywhere. I don't have to take your call. If I throw a party, I don't have to invite you. There is no law that says that I have to be your friend. Mm-hmm. You're a fucking bitch or an asshole. You're rude all the time. You make me feel like shit. I don't like you.
Yeah. And I think part of that is learning to realize to be okay with the consequences of your behavior, even if that behavior is misunderstood.
Well, and I think like someone like you would say things like that, which is not wrong. But I also feel like then there are some people who would think, well, maybe I should just try to be nicer. Like why do I always have to take everyone to task? Like,
but it's not about, you're putting the onus on this Black woman to be nicer and not difficult, which is already a problematic
that is
cliche.
A stigma and a stereotype.
And,
yes.
And where's the grace from other people realizing like this person's not acting in a way that I'm used to dealing with, but how come nobody else can be patient and try to be like, oh, maybe that's the way that I'm also communicating is not helping the scenario with this Black woman per se that I have to label as difficult and just want to is strange, really.
I agree with you.
And I think the effect that has on somebody who has said that, whether or not she actually is autistic, I don't know now, but has said that, you know, people on the spectrum are very sensitive to feeling like an alien. It's like, you know, over, you know, decades of peer treatment, I think that is detrimental. To me, how she's behaving... And maybe I heard myself sometimes in a few things she says is a self-defense mechanism. And I think collectively we need to be more patient with everybody and have a little grace for people.
Because I agree with you.
I don't like that fucking publicist that did that. One, if I get turned away at the door once, I'm not going back three times. But what that message that was being sent to her was like, collectively all these other people are worth being here, but not you specifically.
Okay,
but,
see, I don't agree. I side with the publicist because Amanda Seales is giving a one-sided story. The only thing we know for sure is that the publicist said, bitch, I don't like you, and that's why I'd invite you to my party. But Amanda Seales didn't include like any rationale for why this woman, and I believe Shannon Sharp did try to press her, like, why didn't she like you? And she didn't have an answer for that. She's like, I don't know. Yeah, Shannon Sharp did ask her that, and she says, I don't know. Well, that's important because there are a lot of people you don't like. There are people whose names I say and you're like, ugh, I don't want. Okay, what's the difference? Like, there are people I don't like that if you tell me, do you want to, or things I don't want to do, that if you say, do you want to do this or see this person, I would immediately say no.
No, but so, this is a business. These are all
it's not a business.
Coworkers.
It's a party. Here's the thing. I agree with you in the sense that like there are certain environments where we need to take a step back and try to understand people's behavior, like at work, like if you're an educator or even as a person out in the world. Like when I go to the store and people behave in a way that's kind of crunchy, I think like, well, let me not. It's like road rage. You know, I drive like I put on my spa music and just drive and try to not get aggressive. But whenever people are aggressive with me, I think, okay, maybe they had a bad day. Maybe something happened to them and they're upset. I'm not going to absorb that and try to be reactionary. So I agree with you that we should take the time to try to understand people's perspectives. But I also think that that can't always be an excuse for people like her, like you, like a lot of people, where it's like there's always an excuse for why we should tolerate certain behaviors. I don't care if you have a diagnosis or not. Like, you are articulating that people don't like me, and these are the reasons why. I understand that because I'm XYZ, that people are rubbed the wrong way by that. Okay, so then maybe, at what point are you going to realize that maybe that's a reason why people don't want to fuck with you? But we have to take a break. Hold on.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, I'm talking too much about this, but
it's fascinating, really. But
I do agree with you and everything you said, and especially being a Black woman and knowing that there's that stigma attached to it. But what I did want to say is that I think the difference on a show like Insecure is the showrunner is a Black woman. The cast is almost predominantly Black, and so is the crew. So we're not talking about like a corporate setting with a bunch of white people who are just seeing her as like an angry Black woman. It's like, girl, you're around a bunch of other Black folks who also think that you are too much. She used that word in 3 hours a lot. Everyone thinks I'm too much. Well, shit, bitch. Like, I mean, I just don't know what to tell people like this. Like, you constantly say, I know I'm too much. But then you make that the song that's playing with your violin. It's like, oh, I know I'm overwhelming. I know I'm too much. Yeah, period. Like, it's too much for people. I don't have to like that. I don't want to deal with that. So what about the people who have to deal with her? What's the capacity? How much do I have to deal with? How uncomfortable do I have to be around her? Is what I'm saying. That's how she seems. She, like, the way people feel about her, because I'm telling you, the entire interview, all she does is talk about how no one really fucks with her. And it's just amazing. But I want to shift to something more positive, because the thing that I'm most impressed with her by is her education. And when she talked about how, because she talks about how she auditioned for something at Disney, mm-hmm. and she called Disney racist. And then she went on to say that she was a kid, and that at the audition there were other kids, and at some point they were making fun of her and using the N-word towards her. So of course that's not okay, and certainly is racist.
Yes, in Florida in the 90s, yes.
In Florida in the 90s. But Shannon, who's not a conversationalist, who is not well equipped to communicate with this woman, instead of him asking her, how does those children's behavior translate to you calling Disney as a corporation racist? Instead of him saying that, he questioned her experience. Mm-hmm. And he does that a few times. And that's another headline I've been seeing, is that Shannon Sharpe is basically trying to perpetuate these sort of like anti-racist sentiments, like protecting white supremacy. And I don't know that,
I think those were knee-jerk reactions based on his own experiences, but I think that's where he shows that maybe he's not the best interviewer.
Yes.
But it's like, yeah, these little ass children that are saying the N-word, they grow up into racist adults, you know?
Well, my other issue too is like, if I were talking to Shannon and he says something like that to me, my immediate thought would not be that he's protecting white people. My immediate thought would be, this is an older Black man with darker skin than mine who grew up in the South. He would certainly have a different perspective from mine. And uh-huh. so I would value that perspective. So then what Amanda Seales says is, she goes, you know, I would invite you to appreciate the fact that I'm a scholar of race. Like, I'm not just talking about my experiences. I have a graduate level education studying race. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about these things, it's backed up with facts. Mm-hmm. So maybe you should take the time to, maybe instead of trying to question me, try to listen to me.
Listen to me and respect the fact that I know what the fuck I'm talking about.
And I thought that in that segment, that's where she really shined. Mm-hmm. Although it's like, I would ask the same of her. Like, you have this older, like, you know, essentially like an elder in front of you whose experience as a Black person has been less privileged than yours, because she acknowledges that she had a more privileged upbringing because she was middle class. She had access to educators who supported her. She's also fair skinned. So it's like,
but
as it just seems like she can't give anyone else grace, but she wants all of it.
Sure. And you know, maybe you catch people at the wrong time. I think she's probably most certainly able to give grace herself, but this was her interview. So I also get this. I also felt like her responses to him were valid sometimes, clapping back.
They were, for sure. Like,
but also you have to think, yes, he is an older Black man from another generation, but if he were the teenager at Disney, I feel like he would have had a different, I think would have experienced some sort of racism. But as a woman, you know, I think people were freely able, that like they felt like they could say things to her face that she was powerless
sure.
to do anything about, that there probably would have been more of a fear that he would retaliate as a male, you know, like these little dumb white kids. So I think that he doesn't or isn't taking that his maleness into consideration.
I agree. It looked real crazy for him to kind of, because he does it like three times where he questions like, well, you're calling this racist, but maybe it was just this. And I and when he said those things, I cringed a little, like, oh god, but why are you saying that? But
why are you saying that in this context? Because it's not that those things aren't valid to take a step back and be like, look, am I holding on to a narrative that is victimizing myself? But you know what? You know whose responsibility it is to poke her like that is her fucking therapist. Like, not the person interviewing her on this platform.
Well, but again, this is the danger. Well, I mean, I would have to defend Club Shay Shay a little bit, because it's like, people come on knowing what it is. These are extended interviews. Mm-hmm. Who does interviews these long? Interviews this long. These are extended interviews. You know, you might get 5 minutes, you know, two commercial breaks on a late night talk show. You might, you know, if you go on somebody like an Oprah, you might get 30 minutes worth of talking, but you're getting like straight uncut hour and a half, 2 hours. And in this case, 3+ hours. I feel like when you sign up to say, I'm going to do this, you have to be open to like a conversation where someone's going to challenge you. This is not an infomercial for Amanda Seales where she just gets to run on for 3 hours.
Oh yeah. It's for, we're going to dig into stuff.
So
yeah.
For her to sort of feel like, well, he's not supposed to say anything, but to be fair to her, I think that he definitely couldn't handle the kind of conversation she wanted to have.
Yeah.
And so to get back to the positive, I really think that Amanda Seales' strength is in her comedic ability and her knowledge of race.
Oh yeah.
So I really would love to see her transition to like getting out of this energy where it's like, she's a victim, everyone's against her.
But collectively, we also have to help her get out of that too. We can't, everybody's just going to rag on her all the time for being difficult. Part of that narrative has to come, that narrative change has to come from outside too.
You know, Charlemagne the God wrote a new book and it's about social media. And there's one point, there's a chapter in it that, I can't say because use the N word, but it's basically about how like our algorithms make us think that things that really aren't that big are like massive, which mm-hmm. we all know, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that Amanda Seales seems to be caught in that world. Like, okay, so these
a riptide.
Because even in the Club Shay Shay interview, she talks about like the like Black Twitter and the blogs bringing her name up, but it's like, that's a very small segment of the world and of social media and of entertainment. So I almost feel like she needs to like dig herself out of that.
She does. And you know what? It might be as simple as like turning the damn phone off. Like who cares? Don't you read about celebrities that deleted their, well, X now or whatever.
Social media. Yeah.
Like, cause it's just like, you gotta get out of that wind tunnel of noise.
Yeah.
For your own.
Well, you know, she also has a radio show, a podcast. She does other things. She's always on Instagram Live running her mouth. And I think it's like, I think you talk too much.
Yeah.
Which gets you into trouble. And why not just form, you're very good at forming very good critical thoughts in a comedic way. Do another stand-up special. Like, just focus on that or something and get your point across in a way that's more controlled and leaves you less open to criticism.
But, you know, the segment I also listened to, got through, was she speaks to not feeling like she's not viewing herself like a celebrity. And it's like, you know, maybe someone needs to tell her, like, you are better than social media and smarter than social media. And you don't need that anymore. You don't need Instagram Live. And I don't know if there's some, you know, sense of feedback and automatic reaction response that we're all kind of addicted to by using these things long term. But, yeah, I think she should just abandon all of that and focus on her creative talents because she's incredibly talented.
I would if people are interested in this topic, I would recommend the Club Shay Shay interview with Amanda Seales. It's quite zesty.
Because you and I talk, like, if I were ever lucky enough to choose between a luncheon with Amanda Seales or Issa Rae, I mean, I would pick Amanda. I think I'd have a great conversation with her.
I could see myself being friends with Amanda, but it would be one of those like, okay, girl, I'm done. Like, we're not about to argue about this. Like, I'll see you next week. Like, because you get on this bullshit and you ramp up, and that's what reminds me of you. It's just like, oh, here we go. Like, it's just like he's gonna just ramp up, and then there's no stopping him. So I'm checked out. But let's move on to the restaurant section.
Sometimes those skills really come in handy.
Like how you like to interrupt me when I'm trying to move on. Restaurant section. You were in Boston.
Yes.
And I guess we won't talk too much about that, except that you did try a couple restaurants that you wanted to complain about.
Oh, no. Well, okay. Some good pizza. What was that place called, though, again? I was staying in the North End.
What makes good pizza to you?
The crust.
The crust, of course. What's your preferred crust situation?
I don't have a preferred. I think we grew up and my family was very conscious about weight because my parents didn't want fat kids. So I think I don't like thin crust these days. but that's different than like a Neapolitan crust.
I never know how to say that word.
A Neapolitan crust I do like, but it's, you know, cooked in a certain way in the pizza oven. The terminology I saw towards a lot of the better restaurants advertising pizza was brick oven in Boston. And I was staying very near a place and somebody said, oh, don't use that one. Get Regina Pizzeria. And there was one in walking distance from where I was staying. And I got the, what did I get? It started with a G. Anyway, it was very good. And I don't like waiting in line. And something told me that it's probably a popular restaurant. So I just ordered to pick up. And there was a huge line at dinner time on that one night. And I'm so glad I got to eat my little cute hotel room, but it was very good pizza and I ate it all in one sitting and then I felt ill. But yeah. And then I ate at an Italian place that was recommended to me called Tony and Elaine's.
Oh, here we go. Okay.
which reminded me of what's that place in West Hot? Connie and Ted's. These straight couple restaurant names. Anyways, Italian, very cute. I made a reservation because again, don't like to wait. And brought my little book that I was reading and had some house wine. And then they didn't have a huge menu, but I don't usually eat seafood with you because we share each other's food and you don't like seafood. So I'm like, let me get this lobster ravioli.
This is another narrative of yours, is that you miss out on a lot of things because of me.
I don't think I miss out on them. If I never have seafood
you
again.
You can order seafood if you want to. I can eat my own food. I don't need to share your plate.
If I never have seafood again, I'll be fine because I've had it. And most of the time, to be honest, when I get things with shrimp in them, I'm disappointed in the amount I get for the cost that it is. So it's just easier to get chicken. Anyway, I had this lobster ravioli that was like $36. Okay. I got six little ravioli discs filled with the lovely ricotta cheese that I could eat all day. With some sauce and on top, some mangled lobster bits that are sprinkled over it, like large chunks of Parmesan cheese. That was the lobster. That was not worth that to me. I did not need that. Another reason why I'm wary about ordering seafood at places. Anyway, fine. Ambiance fine. I was in and out of there. And I'm thinking, oh, then my last day I was running around Chinatown I'd looked up this dumpling place and when I got to it I was like, ooh, I'm not eating in there. And then I went to a Vietnamese place across the way called Pho Pasteur. This was one of the worst meals I had in a long time and the service was terrible. When I sat down and saw the menu and all their like best rated things were from the mid to late 90s. I was like, oh, I might be in trouble. But I'm seated and I was tired and it was cold. You know, fucking Boston felt windier than Chicago. Anyway, maybe I was in a Cantonese frame of mind, but when I ordered my crispy fried lo mein and what I got was this hare's nest, I was so disappointed in that meal. I cannot tell you. I was so mad.
This is why the more experienced I get at eating out, like a red flag for me is a menu with too many items, because then they're just mixing and matching things and probably holding on to like bases for too long, especially mom and pop restaurants. You think every night they're throwing out like the base of whatever soup, and no, they keep that shit until it's gone. So shit doesn't taste fresh. And so that I really, if I opened up a restaurant, we were saying this yesterday, I would focus on like signature dishes and that would be it.
Uh-huh. Well, they had a lot of things on the menu, small print, like 4 to 5 pages, probably four. And I hadn't sat down for 30 seconds when somebody ran over and was like, are you ready? I'm like, no, I need to look. I'm not even past page one. I am reading the ingredients, okay?
Speaking of signature dishes, we went to Chin Chin's yesterday.
Haven't been there forever, yeah.
We went to there's more than one, but we went to the one in Sunset Plaza, mm-hmm. which I have memories of because when we first moved to LA, I was working at a place in Sunset Plaza. But we went. I don't know why I thought that. Well, you know, I know why I chose to go there, because I didn't tell you we were going there until we started driving, because I knew they had easy parking. So that's why I went. But they have their signature, like, world famous chicken salad, like Asian Chinese chicken salad. That shit, you know what that tasted like to me? If when you go to, like, the grocery store and buy the bag salads, and you buy, like, the Asian salad bag.
Yeah, with those little styrofoam things.
Yep. And if you took that and then you took canned chicken and then you took some of, like, you go to the cold section of the, like, the produce where they have the nicer salad dressings, and you buy, like, the ginger Asian
ginger cilantro, yeah,
something, and you mix the canned chicken with that and then dump that on the bag of salad. That's what this salad tasted like.
What a dump.
It wasn't gross. It was just like
the way that was advertised, though. It's like,
I thought I was about to get something like out of this world,
something,
and it was like so basic. You got some chicken that I thought was good.
General Tso's chicken. Well, it's hard to fuck that up, even though it's not, you know, it's American dish.
Would I go there again? Yes. You know, the biggest deterrent is the manager.
God, he talked to me for too damn long.
Oh my God, he was really trying hard to get Yelp reviews.
Yes,
and like basically begging for like a Yelp review for a free dessert.
I'm like, I don't need free anything,
which,
sir.
I hate when they do that, because it's like, because then they want to see the review, and it's like, well, what if I don't want to give you 5 stars? Like,
well, right.
That, I mean, and also, it's, since I work for, you know, I've worked in a capacity where like we have to monitor reviews and try to get reviews for products. It's against the rules to offer like rewards for reviews. Yes. So, you know, that's what we're doing that.
But
anyway.
I think also when guys see two men, they think that we're going to be laid back and be like, yeah, sure. But God, because you went to the bathroom right away, as you were wont to do when we get somewhere. And he talked and talked to me like, did you have breakfast today? Or is this your first meal? It's kind of early to have Chinese food. I felt manic. Like, why is he talking to me this long?
So since I used to work, when I worked in Sunset Plaza, it was like, what, 12, 13 years ago. So clients would often get us food from Chin Chin's. And so I was very familiar with their food, but also they're known for their chocolate covered fortune cookies. Mm-hmm. You have to buy them. The fortune cookies they give you with your bill are just plain fortune cookies. But if you want the chocolate covered ones that are done by some confectionery place in Beverly Hills, I think. Uh-huh. So the quality of the chocolate is nice. You have to buy them. So I said, oh, I want to buy the fortune cookies. So when we told the manager, like, oh yeah, you can bring the bill and a bag of the cookies. He went on again about, are you sure I can give you them for free if you write it? Like, I'm like, I'm happy to buy these fortune cookies if you leave me the hell alone. Like, give me this damn check. But yeah, I would go back if for nothing else than the
well, you know, we could make those cookies at home. They're not hard.
Okay, moving on. There were a couple of questions. One, God, we're gonna have to take another break probably soon. Okay. Why do actors like John Travolta, Nicolas Cage, and Bruce Willis fall off? Well, I think Bruce Willis, his medical condition probably affected his ability to work. And then we saw a period where I think producers were taking advantage of him, because he was in a string of shit movies for how long? Like five, 6 years?
Yes. Yeah, like hundreds of films.
With Nicolas Cage, I think his financial issues sort of propelled him into doing every movie he is asked to do, because he works a lot. Mm-hmm. So it has to be because he needed money. And then who was saying that he's planning on retiring soon?
I think he said that.
So it's probably because he's finally made enough money that he can, and he's got his spending under control. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think his financial status is what. And then what do you think about John Travolta?
I think it's the same. You know, there's a sell-by date where you are not a draw. You're not considered a draw to producers, to studios, but you still need to work, right? Even if you're wise at spending your money, you're kind of been living a certain lifestyle. You have property to pay for, children whose shit you got to pay for. So it's like you still have to do something, and this is all you know how to do. So you're going to have to take lesser than roles that are, you know, presumably beneath you. But there are other ways that, like, if you're really passionate about the craft of acting, that's when you see a lot of people go to Broadway, right? Or they go to the stage or do stage work, or they go to Europe or try to expand their filmography in some other way. But this is a cheap and easy. There's a whole market for shit like what Travolta and Cage until recently have been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're just, I mean, there are a lot, you know, it's like every year there's a new, there are constantly new people trying to get into acting. And mm-hmm. so you think like the pool is just really big. And so for some of these people, all they have, like it's hard enough to get roles. And then you think, oh, if you're like a notable person who's kind of like aged out, then I guess you're relegated. I think John Travolta also, I mean, not to be mean, but I think he looks like a monster. So I don't know what, like what roles would work for him except something like Cash Out, where it's just this stupid, stupid movie and story.
And see, the thing is, the problem with doing things like that is once you start dipping your toes in there, it's like being in debt. It's really
well, your hot. Stock plummets.
Your so stock now it's plummets.
Like, who's going to hire you, like fucking... Ari Aster is not going to put you in his next movie.
Or they might, you know, like Tarantino kind of resuscitated Travolta's career with Pulp Fiction, right? Because he was already kind of in the doldrums with those goddamn Look Who's Talking films and considered not to be quality, right? And I think that there are certain filmmakers that can, you know, rescue you a little bit or make you notable, make the shine come back for a second. But Cage is really interesting because he's been able to
he flip-flops between like really good projects and really terrible.
Well, but he's also made us understand that he can still be good even if he's in shit.
It's, yeah, his brand is very much like he can go all over the place and people still accept that.
Yes, and I don't know that that works for most people.
Like John Travolta, if you saw him in a real movie, you'd be like, what the fuck is he doing?
Right. Like a woman that comes to mind of a certain age that has had to do this a lot too is Sharon Stone.
Oh, sure.
Who I think is better than a lot of the things she's been in. And speaking about difficult women, I think the stories I've heard about her are that she's also difficult. But and sometimes you'd get to a point where you're more difficult than you're worth, right?
The next question we got several comments from the video for the, oh God, what was that movie with Henry Cavill, Ungentlemanly?
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Basically, because I had commented that all of the actors are like they're all so attractive, like more attractive than the actual people, and I find it amusing. And so there were a lot of comments like, why does that matter? And I think like, well, it does and it doesn't have to. It's just interesting. Like, you know that these people didn't look like this. And then in that movie in particular, at the end, they show pictures of the people these characters are based on, and they're all UGMOs. So it's like,
well,
so it's funny that you hire all these like super good looking guys who have perfect teeth and perfect tans and perfect bodies. And like, you know, they didn't have protein shakes and
yeah, they didn't have these bodies. I think that there's a dangerousness to it in my mind because it makes us normalize like, this is the way we have to see these people, even though they're vastly different than the
I find it distracting.
It is distracting. And I think that there's this projection of these people, they have to be this good looking for us to see them on screen. And it's like, well,
the other thing is just like, you know how like sometimes we'll listen to Dateline in my car and then you'll hear someone say, oh, she was the most beautiful woman. Every time she walked into a room,
she lit up a room.
And so what do I always say?
Look her up.
Look her up. Find a picture. And then you show me the picture and then we both are like, chill. That was a dim light if she did.
Who are you just listening to? Donnell Rollins?
Oh, shout out to Donnell Rollins. I love him so much.
Because he was talking to what's that guy who discovered that you're addicted to?
Funny him? Marco. He has the YouTube show Open Thoughts.
Because Donnell's like, we're too regular faced.
Yeah. He goes, you can't tell me when you were 13, you didn't look in the mirror and understand that you'd have to either be rich or famous to get bitches because you and I are both ugly.
And I don't think that they are, but something about being regular face, it's like, yeah, can we get some regular looking people that are talented?
Like, I think that's what my commentary is probably based on. Is like, why can't anyone just be regular looking? And why do we have to, like, why does everyone have to be this ripped, like, you know, the thing that's more distracting to me are the bodies, because we all think certain people are hot because they have nice bodies. But if they had a normal weight, normal as an American, like overweight, they wouldn't look like that.
A paunch.
Yeah. If Henry Cavill gained 50 pounds of fat, he would look like your uncle.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's not, if certain people didn't have the hair they have, which sometimes not even actually their hair,
yep,
you wouldn't think they're that attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm saying, is that it just is a little distracting, and it's kind of boring that, like, just you have to make everyone hot.
Well, and that's kind of, everybody has different, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. I think it's just like, I don't know why we have to have these people. It just seems like also they're really wasted, especially in that movie where, like, Henry Golding, who's a very attractive man, why is he in this role? Why did you even do this movie? You have nothing to do in it.
Okay, we have 3 minutes to get through films released we didn't cover, so it's a speed round.
Good luck with that.
Well, I'm gonna stop recording, so if you don't get through them, that's on you. Number one, Alien was re-released.
I'm not going to be pushed.
You're wasting time.
Okay, then we're just not gonna do it. I'm not gonna rush through this section like that. You can't do that to me. I have notes on these things. So I guess we'll sit quietly until, like, I'm not going to rush.
Projects of interest. The Ritual.
No, I'm going.
This podcast can't be 2 hours long. Are you going to go through the films released we didn't cover in a timely manner?
Yes, in a timely manner, but you can't put that kind of constraint on me.
Alien. Jesus.
Yes, one of the best films of all time. You want me to rush through that?
How many times have you talked about Alien?
I was just going to urge people that if they haven't had the opportunity to see it in a theater, which I have said several times.
Are you saying that you could have gotten through that quickly, but you were trying to make a point? So this harkens back to Amanda Seales and how you and her are similar, that you want to argue about nothing. Like, you could have gotten through that quickly.
No, but I don't want to, because I have to bring up notes that I have on these that are on separate things. Like, I don't want to be rushed. I think it's fair.
So then... But you'd be surprised if I said you're difficult to work with.
No, you say that, you let the world know that. That's why I empathize with Amanda Seales.
Mm-hmm. The Mummy.
I don't know why they're re-releasing this. Is it because of the strike that we're re-releasing all these fucking movies? Like,
that's a good question, actually.
Like, why is The Mummy?
Because what year? What year was Alien? Like, what's the anniversary?
Well, it's 45th year for that.
I think 45 is a weird year. It's like you could do 25, 50.
But
what about The Mummy?
Is that 25? Because that was 99.
That's, oh, okay. 25 is fine. What was The Mummy a big hit?
I guess it had several sequels, and then The Rock did The Scorpion King.
Oh, sure. Okay. I don't know that I've seen The Mummy.
Oh, Brendan.
But I did like the Tom Cruise The Mummy, which I know people didn't like.
I don't remember liking it. Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz, anyway.
Boy Kills World.
I was mildly interested in this. It's described as a fever dream action film that follows Boy, a deaf person with a vibrant imagination. When his family is murdered, he's trained by a mysterious shaman to repress his childish imagination and become an instrument of death. And the lead is Bill Skarsgård. I was surprised that you passed on this.
Is Bill Pennywise?
Yes.
I do like Pennywise.
I know you do.
Yeah. Breathe.
Well...
we wanted to watch this.
We did want to watch
but this. But I refuse to use our fish jelly money to buy this movie.
No, to rent it, because there were no publicists that reached out to me, that no one was interested, as they say, soliciting a review. I am interested in watching this, but yeah, I don't want to pay $15 to rent it. Are you kidding?
Jennifer Hudson, Mila Jovovich, the rapper Common. Well, he's an actor too. They're in this like post-apocalyptic... environment where oxygen's at a premium. It looked like a COVID film.
It did. I don't understand how all these people were in it. Sam Worthington is in it.
And what can we, how are you in like the highest grossing films of all time, meaning the Avatar films, uh-huh, Sam Worthington, and he just can't, we've reviewed several films with him that were awful.
What was that Nine Bullets film? Like, what are you doing, man?
Oh,
and I heard he's a dick to work with.
People liked our Nine Bullets review because we were going on about how shitty it is. So if for the people who always say they like our bad reviews, I'd recommend Nine Bullets.
And that's when you had glued a hairpiece to my head.
And that's also when Nick is wearing a touffle. Yeah.
Yeah.
The feeling that the time for doing something has passed.
This was on the tips of everyone's tongues at Cannes last year in the director's fortnight. And it came out this week. I have a screening link. I still haven't watched it. Directed by Joanna Arnau. And it's about, it's a film about, I believe she's Jewish and she's having a long-term casual BDSM relationship. That's all I know about it, but it sounds interesting.
Casual BDSM relationship?
Yeah.
Okay. Next, Infested.
I saw this. It was in the Venice Critics Week. Shudder has released it. When I saw it, it was called Vermin.
Oh, you did see it.
Yeah. It's called, I have a written review out there for it from last September. Apparently it's called Infested now, and it's a French film about spiders that I didn't like, directed by Sebastian Vanacek. But unless you're like a gung-ho for creature features, I think I didn't care for this.
Nowhere Special.
God, I got so many emails to review this. It stars James Norton, who you've seen in some stuff. I think he was in that movie with Gemma Arterton where he's the spy with more than one identity. Anyway.
I like Ed Norton, but let me see.
This is James Norton. But it's directed by...
Oh, he looks like Ryan Phillippe.
Yeah, he's very handsome. It's directed by Uberto Pasolini.
Oh, the movie you just referenced where we reviewed, or where he was a spy, the director reached out to us to thank you for the nice review.
The title of that was, again, it's escaping me. But Uberto Pasolini, who I was like, I know he's not Pasolini's child because he was a homosexual.
Shout out to Rogue Agent.
Rogue Agent,
we thought that was a good movie.
Yeah, we like that.
Starring James Norton.
But Uberto Pasolini is the nephew of Visconti, another homosexual. Anyway.
Lastly, Slam.
Speaking of re-releases, I haven't seen this. I would be interested. It's directed by Mark Levin and won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance in 98. And it's about a talented Ute played by Saul Williams who copes with urban crime and despair by competing in poetry slams. Doesn't that sound like 1998 indie American film?
I think I actually watched this trailer. Yes. Yeah.
Sonia Sohn of The Wire is also in it, but I would watch that.
Projects of Interest, The Ritual.
God, all of these. This, if you read the description of it, it sounds just like an Exorcist remake. But Al Pacino and Dan Stevens are the young and the older, the old guard and the new guy that have to combat a demon. It's directed by David Medell, who did something else that I have not seen. But anyway, I like Pacino, and Dan Stevens is having a busy year. Jesus.
Apartment 7A.
So Natalia Erica James, who I believe is from New Zealand, and we reviewed her film Relic, which I
saw Erica James and thought that was The Real Housewife of Beverly Hills.
Nothing that exciting here. We reviewed her film Relic, which I liked. She apparently the shot in 2022, she did a prequel to Rosemary's Baby.
Oh.
And it's called Apartment 7A, and it's about that woman that kills herself at the very beginning of Rosemary's Baby, like the woman they first tried to get impregnated by the devil. I forget her name, but I've read that book and I love that film. But apparently Julia Garner and Diane Wiest, who I love, so that could be interesting. It could be.
Untitled Peter Greenaway.
Love Peter Greenaway. His Walking to Paris movie, apparently, that he's been filming or doing things to for over a decade. Apparently that's ready to come out this year, but he apparently is in Italy starting another project with Helen Hunt and Dustin Hoffman, the story of a man who wants to organize his own death in an elegant, sensible, and tidy manner. You know Greenaway now because I made you watch The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, so I'm glad he's still working, even though he's been saying for years that cinema's dead, but whatever, still making it.
On our Patreon last week, we reviewed Peggy Sue Got Married. Mm-hmm. So people can check that out. Unfortunately, there is an entry in the obituary section. Laurent Canté.
He is notable. He won the Palme d'Or in 2008 for The Class, which I think that was the Sean Penn-led jury. Was it? Yes. No? Yes. Sean Penn's a dumb. I didn't really like this film. It feels very... I feel it feels very of a time that they would have awarded something like this. Anyway, I like Laurent Canté. apparently he was ill. He wasn't young. I've reviewed his last several films. I think his best is a film about sex tourism starring Charlotte Rampling called Heading South. He did some film, I think, about people in Cuba called Return to Ithaca. I haven't loved anything he's done recently, but he's a filmmaker of note, and he's now dead.
Let's take another break. The secret film this week was my choice, and I chose the 1998 American romantic dance drama, Dance With Me, starring Puerto Rican singer Cheyenne and Vanessa L. Williams, our first Black Miss America. Why did I choose this movie? I noticed Vanessa Williams released a new song called Legs. Keep Dancing. Which is kind of catchy.
Yeah, it's cute.
Because the lyrics are like, they say the legs are the last to go. I'ma keep dancing. Mm-hmm. Like, I still putting on a show. We watched the video. The video is a little crunchy.
Well, it's that Braxton mode of...
It's very Braxton. It's very Trina, Party or Go Home, mixed with Tony's I Heart You.
Tree.
Certainly Vanessa's doing more dancing
yes.
than the other two. But yeah, it feels very 2009. It has that gauzy filter to it. But I really like Vanessa Williams.
I do too. Vanessa L. Williams.
Vanessa L. Williams. Not to be confused with old girl from
Candyman.
And Melrose Place. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I had never seen Dance With Me. Neither had you.
Nope. I remember my family bypassing this film at the VHS video store many times, though.
Well, there was a smart choice because this movie was garbage, mama.
My dad's like, I'm not renting that.
I'm going to say what the premise is. The IMDb premise gives away the plot twist. Rafael Infante comes to Houston from Cuba to work at John Burnett's dance studio. He meets Ruby Sinclair, a cute dance instructor there. Chemistry? Will John know he's Rafael's dad? That's it. So they give away that Kris Kristofferson's character is Cheyenne's father. Now, you can tell from the opening that that's probably what this is leading to.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they dragged the shit out for a while.
This is directed by Randa Haynes, who's probably in the last theatrical feature she did. But she had a string of films in the 90s. But she's best known for her 1986 film, Children of a Lesser God, which Marlee Matlin won her Oscar for, famously over Sigourney Weaver for Aliens. But yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay, let me get through this story. So Cheyenne plays this guy, Rafael Infante, and we see that he lives in Cuba, and he has written a letter to Kris Kristofferson because we find out that Cheyenne's dad recently or his mom recently died, and Kris Kristofferson is his dad. His mom and Kris Kristofferson had an affair on an Italian cruise ship, and she became pregnant, but the mom never told Kris Kristofferson. So she went back to Cuba and raised her son. Although later on we learned that she did try to tell him, but Kris Kristofferson's dad was fielding the phone calls and never told him, which is a plot point that makes Kris Kristofferson believe that he's the father. But he writes his dad a letter saying, my mom just died and
I need a job.
So can I come work for you in Texas? And Kris Kristofferson says, yeah, come on. And I guess we can talk about it more, but we never learned sort of the amnesty of it all. How did the immigration work that got
him? He just has a line where he says, just run, like, it's really hard to get to the US from Cuba. Could you help others or
whatever? Anyway, he shows up to Texas and we see that Kris Kristofferson runs a big dance studio and they only have like a handful of people participating in this dance studio. And we see that they're in the middle of rehearsing for a big competition
in Vegas,
but the people dancing are all real mediocre seeming.
Yeah. Like who honestly here thinks
what is this competition? Anything? Yeah. But one of the instructors there who isn't mediocre is Vanessa L. Williams. She plays Ruby Sinclair. And Vanessa, her backstory is she is a single mom mm-hmm. trying to raise this kid who seems like he's touched. there's something up with that kid. But she is trying to go pro. So she's practicing to go to the competition as well. But her baby daddy is a professional dancer. And also seems to be a homosexual and a complete asshole.
Oh, he is a douche. And you cannot tell me that man is hetero. No, no.
So she is trying to be a pro dancer and a mom. And when Cheyenne and Vanessa L. Williams meet, it's clear Cheyenne is attracted to her. But she's kind of turned off by him because he says something rude to her. Like,
she's stiff.
That she's stiff. So they end up going on a date, which also doesn't go well because he leaves her to go dance with another woman, which we can talk about. Uh-huh. But then they end up having a fun night just to go out dancing. Like, it's not a date, it's just dancing. And that's when we get the first big dance montage, which was whatever. And then we see them go to the competition, but they're dancing separately. Like, Cheyenne's dancing with Jane Krakowski, which we can talk about. Uh-huh. And Vanessa L. Williams decides to go back to her ex because she knows that they'll win and she can be famous. And that's what happens. She wins. And then we see her get offered a contract to be a professional dancer, which was so corny. But we get...
Yeah, she leaves that man just sitting there.
Well, because then the final scene is her... She decides to get up and dance with Cheyenne. Uh-huh. And they have a big dance moment. And then we flash forward to them. Now they're a couple. And her hair is curly, and they now run Kris Kristofferson's dance studio because he's decided to retire and move to like a house on the beach a mile away.
Although he's still lurking in the background. Why?
This movie was boring. The story was dumb. The writing is terrible. These characters don't make sense.
I did not like this film.
So Cheyenne is Puerto Rican. I don't know why they have him playing a Cuban. I don't know why it was important for him to be Cuban. I think it would have made more sense for him to be Puerto Rican. That way him coming to Texas would be an easy task. And we could focus on him talking to his dad about the fact that he's his son.
Yeah, you could still keep those plot elements right there. But yeah, why Cuba? You couldn't even film in Cuba.
Okay, but Cheyenne at that time was a popular like Latin American singer. And Vanessa L. Williams was also quite popular because she had already had two popular albums. She had had that, I think by that time, was Lion King.
Lion King, Pocahontas, all those things were out.
Yeah, Pocahontas was already out. So yeah. She had had, and then, you know, Save the Best for Last, that album was really popular. So she had had a big career already. And she had done a movie.
This was after Eraser.
Right. So you have two notable people.
And Soul Food.
Yes. Yeah. So you have two notable people in this movie about like Latin dancing is what the poster would indicate.
Yeah.
But they don't really dance together.
No.
They only do it the one time at that big club scene where like he's at like a Cuban club where he's dressed like he reminded me of Jim Carrey from The Mask mixed with Ricky Ricardo.
You know, an actual Cuban.
And then they separate, and then each of them dance with other people, and then we don't see them dance again until the end. Not the championship performances, but like at the nightclub after the competition.
Where they take up the whole dance floor. When I told you, like, the last thing I want to do when I want to dance is have some couple hogging the floor like that.
Sometimes being predictable is better, and I think in this instance, this movie would have benefited from just being a standard, like, this... These two people from different sides, like different parts of the world who have no business being together, connect through dance and fall in love. But of course, there's going to be, you know, a moment when they fall apart, but then they get back together. I think making it more simple would have made sense because these supporting characters just, the movie's 2 hours long. It's way too long.
It's 2 hours, 7 minutes.
It's way too long. Okay, so we have Jane Krakowski in the thing. She's one of the people in the dance studio who, we spend a lot of time with her practicing. She's Kris Kristofferson's dance partner.
Which makes no sense.
No.
He is he is no business.
And then her plot point is that she really needs to win this, even though she's an amateur and I didn't get a sense of who she seems like. A housewife, because she drives a nice car and has all this time to just dance and doesn't talk about anything else.
Nope.
And then Kris Kristofferson, his heart's not in it, so he's like not lifting her well and not dancing well.
I think this is the same year Blade came out. Also,
we even get a scene where Jane Krakowski goes to Kris Kristofferson and confronts him like, I need this to happen, and if your heart's not in it, then you need to let me go and I can dance with someone else. And so he does, and she starts dancing with Cheyenne. So it's like we have that entire plot point that served no purpose. Then you have Joan Plowright and the lady from Tu Wong Fu,
Beth Grant,
who's the receptionist. Mm-hmm. You have these two old ladies lusting after Cheyenne, which was so cringy listening to the receptionist lust after him. Yeah. And then Joan Plowright, she's this old rickety lady who every time she sees Cheyenne dancing with Jane or Vanessa, she's like, I want to do that. I want to do that.
I love Joan Plowright. And I wanted one of those hooks from the side of the stage to come out, just yank her out of the
like
movie.
A Showtime at the Apollo when they gong your ass off the stage. She was so annoying. And then at the final championship, this big performance, after Cheyenne and Jane Krakowski perform, Joan Plowright runs out onto the stage and says, I want to do that. And then we get a performance between those two. I can't believe that the judges didn't turn off the music or disqualify Cheyenne.
Get this bitch out of here.
And instead, she gets a trophy.
She snatches a trophy, darling. Yes.
I hated that so much.
Yeah, it was stupid.
Okay, let's go through these notes. Didn't Cheyenne remind you? He reminded me of Michael Jackson.
He reminded me of Michael Jackson, the hair. And I said, who is that guy that played Jackson?
Flex Alexander.
Yes.
Shanice Wilson's husband.
It's uncomfortable in that way.
It was so weird because he's very handsome, and I think Michael Jackson was handsome too, but he has this like weird hairdo. He has a little piece of hair falling out, and then he's very angular like Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. So all the entire time I'm like, this looks like Michael Jackson. Unfortunately, I didn't find Cheyenne as likable as Michael Jackson.
No.
He acts like a big, dumb kid in this movie.
He seems simple.
Oh, he was so annoying.
He was annoying. My first note about him is like, oh, he's written a letter to Daddy.
So he gets hired to be the handyman. And when he first shows up to the dance studio, we see a couple of people almost trip and fall on like a floorboard that's just poking right up, and they're like, sorry, this place is falling apart, this writing was terrible.
Well,
let the audience know that we need a handyman.
We never revisit it. But even before, while we're still in Cuba, which I believe is the Dominican Republic,
meaning that the Cuban scenes were shot in the Dominican Republic,
like he is there's that inside, he's at his mother's grave, then, and that shit looks so fake. But I was so annoyed immediately that the postman is up in his business like that. He's like, oh, you got the letter from John Burnett, the one you've been waiting for. Like, ugh.
He runs around. Okay, the thing I hated about his character most is that he pretends that he doesn't know how to dance with Vanessa Williams. So he's kind of insulting her and making himself seem stupid, like, well, I don't understand how you dance without music, and I don't understand this counting stuff, and like he's stepping on her toes. It makes no sense that someone who can dance like him, like ultimately without any practice, he's just dancing like pro.
He goes, I know how to dance because I'm Cuban.
Like, oh, it was so annoying. And it's like, so you can dance that well, but you couldn't figure out how to do the damn two-step with Vanessa?
Because you don't know technical terms?
Because you want to be a little punk and like act like this is stupid that people count their steps, and like it's just so poorly done that it makes his character seem annoying.
Well, also it's interesting to see this Latin man tell this black woman that she's stiff.
Yeah, I think that it was bad casting or bad writing, one of the two, to have Vanessa Williams in this role where she's supposed to be stiff, but when we see her dance, she's pretty amazing.
She does not look stiff.
She doesn't look stiff. The better Jane Krakowski should have been Ruby Sinclair then.
The Ruby Sinclair, I mean, that just sounds like a character Jennifer Jones would have played.
Oh, God. And then she's driving around in this VW Bug convertible. It makes no sense. Like, her character just seems so, like, the name, the life, the kid, it all doesn't match this woman we see.
Not looking like her, no.
Kris Kristofferson, I thought every time I saw him, I kept thinking, oh, he's probably saying I could have been a Bridges or a Brolin.
What, a Bridgolan?
A Bridgolan. So one of Cheyenne's first jobs at the dance studio is the receptionist tells him, oh, we're having a costume party. You need to decorate the studio. There are decorations in the closet. And when they come back, he has used all of the holiday decorations. So it's Halloween, Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day.
Like a fucking kid would do.
Like a stupid ass kid would do. Why? Why was that? Why are they making him seem so dumb? Okay, then at this costume party, Vanessa Williams is wearing this very sexy nurse's outfit, and we see her dress slowly coming undone. It's like a strapless dress, so of course her breasts are going to show. That was so stupid, because what's happening is that she's dancing quite vigorously, and the zipper keeps coming down inch by inch, and all of the men in the studio stop dancing and start glaring at her, while Cheyenne is looking at her like, how can I help her? And then finally he grabs her and zips up her dress.
But she couldn't feel this?
You couldn't feel that? I don't know, though. You often bend over and your ass is hanging out and you claim you can't tell. So I don't know. But that was so stupid.
Wow.
Well, I mean, okay. Right? Well, or sometimes, like, you know, like your scrotum's hanging out. It's like, you can't feel that?
My God.
Right? Like, you can't feel that?
But not in public.
No, not in public. Well, your ass hanging out, yes, in public. Oh, but God. It's like, she couldn't feel that her, like, breasts were about to pop out. I hated that so much. Mm-hmm. They go to that one bar. The first time Cheyenne and Vanessa Williams go out on a date, they go to this bar, and Cheyenne asks the bartender for a mojito, and the bartender reacts like, whoa, I haven't served a mojito in a long time. You must be from Cuba. And it's like, is a mojito not a popular drink?
They are. Like,
And also, if you haven't served a mojito in forever, would you have mint at the bar?
Well, that too.
Because then if you don't have mint, you, I don't know. I thought that was such poor, stupid writing.
And any, like, remember Chino Latino? Any Latino place had mojitos.
In supporting how dumb Cheyenne is, he asked her to go dancing. Like, this elaborate plan. We get a scene where he's like, in the same room as Vanessa, on pretending to be on the phone, trying to get directions to a bar, but he's too stupid to understand. So then finally Vanessa goes, are you trying to hint that you want to ride to the dance club? So they go.
But she's like standing. It's like, is she microwaving, faxing something? She's like standing there.
It looks like she was trying to fax popcorn or something. I don't understand what's happening. But they get to this club, and immediately Cheyenne starts dancing with another woman. Like, are you dumb? Why do they make this character seem so stupid? Then they're driving. They make amends. And then Cheyenne asks Vanessa for a ride again. I don't know. He's playing her like she's this dumb broad or something. Like, this woman's too beautiful to be playing around with this stupid man.
Yeah.
But he asked her for a ride because he wants to rebuild Kris Kristofferson's, like, classic Chevy pickup truck, which is another side plot. And she drives him somewhere, and they're driving down the highway in this convertible in slow motion.
Oh, yeah.
Because they don't want the hair to blow. Oh, yeah. It looks so crazy. And then they get to this other place, and the guy's like, are you Cuban? I'm Cuban. Come on. And then they start, like, this, like, auto body shop has, like, a restaurant in the backyard.
But oh, my God.
That was so stupid.
What are they doing in the backyard? All these people, and there's, like, some people that are dry humping on the grass.
Okay, that was ridiculous. But we have to talk about, before they go in the backyard, they order two burritos to eat on the street.
Oh my God.
And the way they're eating these burritos, you've never seen someone. First of all, Cheyenne takes the burrito and he takes a big chomp out of it in the middle of the burrito.
Yeah. And then Vanessa clearly is tired of taking burrito
Vanessa
takes.
Is taking the tiniest bites. The tiniest bites you've ever seen.
And you can tell there.
It's just all tortilla. She didn't get any of the filling.
No.
She ate, like, she took six bites and still hadn't gotten to the filling of the burrito.
And you can tell there was a burrito switch in there as well.
And then at one point you could tell. Also, her hair, I have to say, her hair, you know, Vanessa's known for, she likes to wear her own hair. Like, you rarely see her in a wig. And in this film, she, I'm assuming because of the dancing, wanted to have her own hair in. But it does change up a lot throughout the film. And you can tell, but like, from like shot to shot, that they had to touch up her hair. And I feel like maybe it would have been better if she would have worn a wig, because there's a lot going on with her hair that I found distracting. But anyway, they go to, after they make amends, they decide to go out on another like dance date. And that's where we have the big dance scene. And I thought the cinematography was so poorly done, because in any movie where like dance is the focus, the way it's shot, it highlights the dance. But in this film, every time they're dancing, it just feels chaotic and we're not getting people's full movements, especially in that big dance scene and the end during the championship, because they just have like all these people on the dance floor and it just feels like the camera is randomly shooting people.
I think none of the dancing feels like it's highlighted or feels very well done in this. It's kind of odd. And I don't know if that's because maybe the cinematographer that worked on this, Fred Murphy, all of his best work has been in genre films like Stir of Echoes or Mothman Prophecies. So I think maybe this just wasn't his forte.
So when they leave that dance, Vanessa drove there. We see her drive her little convertible VW Bug to the dance. But then when they leave, Cheyenne's walking her home. And he even makes a comment like, I feel like I needed to walk you home. Because she's like, well, you can just go home. But that doesn't make any sense. She drove there. The writing, bad. Then he gets caught in the sprinklers. And I hated that scene because they say their goodbyes. And then he walks across the lawn like an animal. Like, why didn't you use the sidewalk, fool? You got here on the sidewalk. Why are you walking across these people's lawn? And then she turns around like to walk away. And then all of a sudden she goes, oh no. And then the sprinklers come on. So that means she knows the sprinklers come on every night at 10:30. And that somehow she recognized that it was 10:30. And even though she had turned her back to him, she knew he was on the grass. And then what does this man do?
He stays in them.
Stays in the grass with the sprinklers going and does like a Singing in the Rain moment, which was almost as cringy as Jennifer Lopez in at the end of This Is Me Now.
J-Lo's worse, but
she's worse.
It is bad. Like, why you please stop?
So then he's covered and he's wet. And then, of course, Joan Plowright, who was the babysitter that night, she comes out and goes, oh, well, you should invite him in to get dry.
And then the kid comes out and she's like, oh, by the way, I have a son.
I have a son.
Peter.
Who reminded me of that thing from the Goonies. Hey, you guys.
Sloth? What's his name?
Yeah, something like that. So he goes inside, and of course we get the ubiquitous scene where like he's naked with a towel and Vanessa's holding his clothes, smelling them. I don't know how they got dry. She definitely doesn't have washer dryer in unit. And then the clothes are just sitting there. Like, did they air dry? How long has he been at your house?
She's holding his shirt. She's smelling it. And then he walks in with his chest exposed and she goes, oh, this one's almost dry. Like, you're drying with your body heat, girl?
Like, yeah, are you blowing on these clothes?
What's happening?
That made no sense.
And then she gives his jacket like, well, this one's dry. How?
Then they start kissing and she goes, no.
I can't.
So I can't express enough how much I hated Vanessa's baby daddy. Why did they? And I know that that guy is a professional.
He's a real dancer.
He actually designed Vanessa's costumes. But he seems so gay and he's so bitchy. It's like, it doesn't make any sense that this woman would, like, I just don't understand why him.
Well, and then you can tell it's 1998 because they also make it, they work overtime to define his heterosexuality, because we have him eyeing all the other
women,
lady dancers.
We need to wrap this up. We need to talk about the scene where Cheyenne confronts his dad about being his dad.
Oh God.
It was so corny because they're on a fishing scene.
Yep.
And Cheyenne's trying to tell his dad and all of a sudden Kris Kristofferson goes, I don't have no son. Like, damn, he just shut it all down. But then Cheyenne gets mad and says the story about how my mom tried to tell you, because he goes, I know your mom. She wouldn't have just not told me. And he's like, well, she tried, but your dad kept intercepting the calls. And that's when Kris Kristofferson realizes that this guy is my son. I wrote down, the only good thing about this movie is that we see that they're in Vegas for this competition, and there was a billboard for the Monte Carlo, the magic show by Lance Burton. And that reminded me that when I was living in Vegas, I saw Lance Burton perform dozens of times because I had a friend who worked at the Monte Carlo. So that gave me nice memories.
The Monte Carlo. You have to
and then
like
I'm
going to
say something that I'm going to get in trouble for, but I thought Kris Kristofferson looked like if Rue McClanahan transitioned to being male.
You know,
his eyes were so close, he just looked crazy,
you know,
me.
In the, you know, Taxi Driver, in the 70s, 80s, even Kristofferson was quite handsome. There's even a joke about in 30 Rock, Tina Fey finding some homeless person handsome because they look like Kris Kristofferson. But you know, he had an affair with Isabelle Huppert on the set of Heaven's Gate.
Interesting. Mm. Okay, this world championship competition, there were no stakes at all. I don't even understand what this competition was. It's professionals and amateurs. Every time they, like, the judges are rating someone, it's like 100 people on stage. It was so pointless, but I don't understand. Like, the entire film is building up to this competition for everyone. Cheyenne, Vanessa, Joan Plowright, Jane Krakowski, the other people who dance in the studio. They all they do is talk about it, but we don't know what this means for any of them. They don't need the money. Kris Kristofferson has like 6 people at his dance studio, and he's like financially fine. I don't understand why we needed this.
The only thing that would have made this competition better, and I was secretly praying for it, even though I know it wouldn't come, was that this shit needed to turn into They Shoot Horses, Don't They, real quick, and people needed to start dying from exhaustion at this competition.
Well, speaking of that, we get a moment where the professionals are going, and so it's Vanessa and her partner, her baby daddy, and they're having to do all these different kind of dances, which Vanessa looked amazing, mm-hmm. but I just feel like the way it was shot, we didn't really get to see the star of the movie as much as we would want to.
I agree.
But anyway, they, I guess, had to do 5 different styles of dance during this competition. And so right before the last one, all of a sudden, Vanessa's like, my legs are cramping. They're cramping. And it's like, what was the point of that? Because we've already demonstrated that your dance partner's an asshole.
Yep.
This is so incompetently written.
Drama.
It's written by
a dancer, so that's why.
So then, of course, I'm getting flashbacks to Natalie Portman's husband writing that damn
Carmen.
Or doing that damn Carmen remake,
ooh,
which was terrible too.
Yep.
But then Vanessa, of course, wins, gets a trophy, and then she and her baby daddy go to this nightclub where they're playing a song I recognize, actually. But
Yeah,
it was a bigger song. But I was kind of surprised. Oh, it was
Aretha?
It was Aretha Franklin's A Deeper Love.
Yeah, yeah.
But Vanessa gets a contract from this guy for her to sign, and then she like gets up and ignores him to go dance with Cheyenne.
Mm-hmm.
And then the entire club is like looking at these two dancing.
Enamored with these two dum-dums. Like, why are we participating in their courtship? I don't know.
But Vanessa's hair changes at the competition. It gets very blonde. And yes. It looked kind of crazy because it almost looked like, I couldn't tell if those were like clip-in pieces or they actually bleached her natural hair. But it looked kind of crazy. Like, I don't even think that was the style in 98 to have hair like that. But Vanessa's beautiful. She's an amazing dancer. Cheyenne's very handsome. He's also an amazing dancer. It's such a shame that these two very talented and attractive people couldn't make a convincing love, like romantic dance film. It's amazing to me that this is so ineffective.
It's really just painfully dull. I don't know. And I kept thinking of another dance movie with a different Cheyenne Jackson, who I think it's her last movie with Jenna Rollins. It's called like 6 Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks. That's the fucking title of that movie.
Oh.
And I mean, that was more entertaining than this.
What would you give Dance With Me?
1.
I would have to agree. I found this grating, disappointing, annoying. Even the music's not super memorable. Like, it just...
I remember when it came out, it was marketed to the nines, and you were even pulling up old clips on YouTube, like of Vanessa and Cheyenne on Oprah.
Yeah, and other shows doing press.
And Oprah like quoted some critics saying that the two of these people dancing together was like super Viagra.
Viagra. What does Oprah know about Viagra?
What's super Viagra?
Well, we have like a minute left. Do you want to talk about what you're reading?
Oh, well, I just finished reading For Gone by Russell Banks in anticipation of Paul Schrader's adaptation of it, O Canada, because he's previously adapted Banks before. I finished Group Portrait with a Lady by Heinrich Böll, which I found very hard to get through. Now I'm reading Sisters by Daisy Johnson, also in anticipation of Cannes, because Ariane Labed has adapted it.
Thank you for that quality moment. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No.
Ta-ta.